Okay, we're going to get started, and today we're going to talk about screening and assessment. And this is probably the most important, aside from placement, and it goes right along with placement, critical issue associated with developing the job training programs. Last week, in the last session, we talked to Janet Curley from Santa Fe, and she talked to us about developing an awareness. It's kind of a precursor to the screening and assessment practice. How to develop an awareness in the people that live in your community that environmental jobs are good jobs and that they're really their careers. We don't like to look at them as jobs, but more as careers. And looking at that way, we're looking for a different type of person, not someone just to pay the bills on a temporary basis. But she did an excellent job and has a PowerPoint up at the Brownfields site on our website, brownfieldstoolbox.org. And it's brownfields-toolbox.org. You can go up there and see her PowerPoint. But as you go through that PowerPoint, you'll see pictures of people doing environmental jobs. You can't assume that everyone knows what this program's about or what the jobs entail. And a picture does say 1,000 words of people who are doing remediation work, people who are doing transportation work, handling hazardous materials, maybe flagging even transportation and hazardous materials, trucks. And then it goes on to talk about the careers and develops an awareness. And it's a step you can't skip, because if you do, people say, well, what's that? And is it dangerous? Are there hazards involved? Am I going to hurt my health? And so the whole idea of awareness is
hello
very
from Los Angeles.
Hey, who is this?
Michael from Los Angeles Conservation Corps.
Michael. Okay, Michael, good to talk to you. And there's a couple other people who joined. Anyone want to express themselves, their name? Okay, well, we'll go on. And Michael, last week you told me that you're going to be eating potato chips and not to worry about hearing background information. So I am going to repeat that right now for those who just joined. speakers today and microphones are very sensitive. So if you're eating potato chips in the background, we can hear that. Or if you're having side conversations, we'll be able to hear that. So we kind of ask you to be in a quiet room, just a personal phone, or mute your line. We do like to keep open mics. Please never put us on hold, because we might get the music from your organization. So occasionally we just have to do that. We have gotten music, and sometimes we have to talk over it or continue the call at a later date. Anyway, back on the subject, Janet did a great job of talking about developing that awareness. And hopefully when people in the community find out what these jobs really entail, how good the pay is, that it's a career, that it lasts for a while, then we go to the next step, and it's called screening. We call it screening and assessment. And we're going to talk about that today. But before we get too far, we want to have Heather tell us about what's going on in Washington and what's going on with HMTRI right now.
All right. Well, you guys are the first to hear it. This is the exciting news that we've all been waiting on. HQ has given us some indication. It looks like the RFPs should be coming out later this week, maybe next week. But in the immediate future, we should be looking for those RFP to come out. Afterwards, they will update their Brownfields website with the RFP, the facts and questions, as well as the national webinar dates for their grants.gov type of assistance and things like that. So keep an eye out. We will push it out to the listserv. We will push it out to the PLC listserv as well as soon as we hear that those RFPs go live, as well as provide you guys the links to those information that'll be on the EPA's websites as well. So it's coming soon. I hope you all are ready for it. The other big thing that they wanted to share with us as well is that they have decided when they're going to hold the next National Brownfields Conference. So this is sort of a larger conference that's for anybody that really works in the brownfields field, if you will. So they are actually looking at December 10th through the 13th in Los Angeles for this year. Again, that's the National Brownfields Conference, and we're looking at December 10th through the 13th, 2019, in Los Angeles. We don't have any more information in terms of locations or details like that, but they really want to see you guys there. They want to see a really strong EWDJT presence at this national conference because it's a great way to showcase what you guys do and how you guys fit into the overall Brownfields program, as well as you know, a great way to network with people that are hiring, right? People that work in Brownfields that might be potential employers for your students. This is a really good opportunity to get to know them and meet them. So she really, really would like to push for you guys if you're able to attend that event, and then maybe even keep an ear out whenever they start looking for session ideas. They'll kind of send that information out. You know, feel free to contribute and kind of share your viewpoint on what you think would be valuable in a situation like that. So again, December 10th through 13th in Los Angeles. And speaking of meetings, you know, we are progressing where we've sent out our own request to some hotels to see about handling our annual all grantee meeting. So just keep your ear out. We'll send you guys more information as soon as we get some more details on our end. We're just in sort of that planning phase where we have to wait to hear back from some people as well. But we're sort of looking in that August-September timeframe out on the East Coast again for the 2019 HMTRI annual all grantee meeting.
Great. We did have a question of who can attend, and maybe someone who is submitting a proposal this year, but they're not an official grantee, or there may be someone on the call that has not going to or is not going to submit a proposal, but they're really interested in this, and they, perhaps the next round that they'll submit a proposal. So all of those I just mentioned are invited, and what will happen is we'll announce a registration, and at that time you could respond. Usually, and certainly all grantees, all grantee alumni, all applicants are invited to this. We try to get a group of about 125. We get one or two from each grantee, which is about 100 people, and then we get additional people. We'll even have some current or past students that talk about their experiences with the program. And of course, we have a lot of EPA people. We have the assistant administrators. We have all the regional coordinators who you'll be working with throughout the grant or through the selection or work plan process. They'll all be there. We'll have an attorney from EPA, a retiree, who will talk about the do's and don'ts, and a lot of peer-to-peer learning. We have about 22 breakouts and about 8 plenaries, so there's lots of time and a whole lot of networking. Now, as far as costs, there's no cost to the meeting. You have to get to Alexandria, which could be in downtown Washington, but depending on hotel availability. But usually we have in Alexandria, a little less crowded. And the conference, we have working breakfast and lunch. Your dinner's on your own, but the accommodations are covered. But you'll have to pay for your transportation. So that's something to just keep in mind now. If you're working with an organization that's thinking of doing this, you might start mentioning that, you know, if you can, it would be worth their while to send you to this conference. It won't be till end of August or beginning of September, that time frame. So think about it. And certainly all the grantees usually are strongly urged. We usually have almost all of them. One or two may not be able to make it, but almost all of them. And they're a valuable part of the conference because there's a lot of peer-to-peer learning. What are you doing? What are we doing? What are you doing right? What mistakes have you made? And that type of thing. So there's a lot of networking time built into this conference. So enough
and
with
Mike,
what's going on.
I do want to share as well really quickly. Just like we did last year, we will be sending out a scan to you guys at some point as well, asking for your feedback on session topics and things that you think would be really valuable for you to learn and work on. So kind of have that in the back of your brain to let us know if you guys think of any ideas, but we'll send out an official scan probably in a couple of weeks here.
And we try to make it different every year for those of you who go to them. We've done 20 of these, and we try to change it up a little bit. There's certain things that we need to cover. we try to do it in different ways. And when we ask for your ideas, and it's a participatory conference, so we're certainly going to welcome any of your ideas. So we've got plenty of time to work on that. I just wanted to plant some seeds to let you know what's coming up. And, of course, certainly the December conference is a biggie, 3,000 or so people. I think it's really advantageous. For any grantee, it's usually built into their budget, but it's a great place to engage with employers, and particularly the national employers. So, well, let's go on to screening and assessment. And as I said at the beginning of this, placement, screening, and assessment are probably the most important critical issues facing any grantee, and it'll make or break a program. And unfortunately, we've seen it break several programs. We've had people say, we've tried to work with them, and they said, you know, I made a big mistake. I panicked. I needed to fill the class. And it goes back to what Janet was saying the last session. I took the people who signed up first. It was like first in line, came in, I wanted to fill the class. I filled it. I felt really good about it. Once I got into it, I realized I was in over my head, and it's a total wipeout. People are dropping out. They're not motivated. They're not interested in this as a career. It's too hard, one thing after the next. And they said, my biggest nightmare occurred in the first few months of this grant, and I don't know how to get out. And unfortunately, as we were trying to work with these people, there was not an easy way to get out, because that people were just, the retention rates were very small and dropping. We tried to do some fixing up, perhaps reorient their curriculum, try to, I don't want to say dumb down the program, but make it so that they could get some sort of employment at the end of this program. But it just was a disaster. So what I'm saying is, do not rush. What amazes me is when this RFP come out, and it may concentrate more on recruitment, screening, and assessment, but there isn't a lot in that, and I'm surprised because it is so important. But
hello?
What we're saying is, do not rush. Yes.
Hello?
Well, I'm trying to make, welcome. Yes. Okay.
This is James Coleman from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hey, James. Good. Good to talk to you.
Yes, sir.
And I'll make a reminder for everyone. We keep open mics, and if you're on speakerphone, make sure that it's real quiet. Don't answer your phone to talk to anyone, or we'll all hear the conversation. Please don't put us on hold if you have music. If you put us on mute, that's okay. But try to just be quiet for. But we want you to contribute. So anyway, do not rush when we start talking about recruitment. And then the next question is, okay, how do I do this? Tell me how to go about this. And of course, we're going to go through this in the notes we sent to you, but you want to establish a protocol before you even begin. In fact, right now, as we start talking about developing your proposal, do some executive time and start thinking about your screening, your recruitment, and your assessment protocols. And as I said, Janet hit it on the nose. Emphasize the careers and what they mean, and you've got to market it so you get a good sample of people. The more people you have to screen and assess, the better off your class is going to be. This becomes very problematic the more rural you are. When you're in Chicago, L.A., Boston, you might get 100, 150, 200 people that decide they want to do something like this. When you're on a reservation, you may not get anyone at first, and you may start having to do a lot of education and outreach and orientations and seminars and speak at churches or tribal meetings. You have to develop a buzz to start getting. You want to have as many people going to orientation nights as possible. And what I'm going to be talking about will apply to some of you, all of you, or even none of you. And it depends a lot on what your target group is, how big it is, what kind of interest you have, and how many people are going to be applying to get in your program. So we're going to talk about more rigorous and then also less rigorous. But when you think about assessing and setting up your protocol, you've got to think about your target community. You've got to think about what kind of people are you going to be bringing into this program. And that's going to link a lot to your curriculum. if you're working with a rural curriculum who aren't accustomed to academic rigor, you need to work with that target community and your curriculum and what you're going to be offering. And that's going to depend on what kind of demands you're going to make to screen. You've got to really determine what kind of jobs are available. If you're working with in a rural area with a nuclear plant, you're going to have a very different set of screening criteria. If you've got one or two employees who want everyone you can graduate, you're going to work closely with them on your labor market assessment. You're going to say, what do you want? What do you want from our graduates? And they may decide the screening and assessment criteria protocol if they're the only guy in town. If you're in an urban area and you've got lots to select from, now you start talking to primary employers, those who commit to your program. What do you want? What are you expecting your students? They say, sorry, we can't hire anyone with drug issues. They're telling you something. If they say, we work with drug issues, we don't care if they're ex-offenders, or you may have a mix. Some will say, we don't care. We don't care about that. We do drug tests, or we randomly test before they get in the program, or they might say, well, we have ex-offender programs. It doesn't matter because we want quality people who are vetted and can go through the program. These are all going to work into your protocol, and you're going to have to sit down and think about your employers, and that's why we do the labor market assessment. You're going to say, what do you want? So you're going all the way to the back of the program. When you start thinking of screening and assessment, you go to the end of the program and work backwards. What do you want to hire on entry level our students? And that's going to go into what demands are you going to have and how are you going to screen. Another thing, you're going to have to talk to your trainers. What kind of classroom disparities can your trainers live with? For example, we've had grantees who said, I've got 18-year-olds and I've got 60-year-olds. I've got people who haven't sat in a class for 40 years. I've got people who are trades-oriented and some, they never leave the classroom. We're talking about these classroom disparities. Now, believe it or not, people who say we've got old, and they may be, someone may be on the call from this grantee, we've got old and we've got new, and we love it because the old nurture the new. And we have training circles every day, and we sit around. And a lot of what we do is talk about life, talk about the program, and the more experienced people kind of nurture along and take under their wing the younger people. That's one experience. Another one might be, as I said, we've got someone who hasn't been in a classroom for 30 years, someone who just got out of high school. And again, you're going to have to decide in establishing your screening and assessment protocols how much diversity your trainers can take. What are going to be their minimum education requirements? You know, are your instructors going to be doing heavy math? Are they going to be doing something where your kids are going to drop out because they don't have enough background education in math? Are you going to have to issue an assessment test, which I'll talk about in a second? So, again, physical attributes. Are you going to be training people who are going to be doing asbestos removal that with their hands over their heads for 6 hours at a time? Or are you going to be training people that have to SCBA gear, have to use respirators, and they're going to need physicals? They're going to have to pass a physical. Are you going to be doing a mix? You might decide you're going to have two tracks, one for doing phase one analysis on sites where they can perform that in a wheelchair and they can be disabled. And then you may have people who are going to be going into confined space who are going to have to be wearing respirators, and those people will have to take physicals. So, again, there's a whole myriad of issues I just brought up, and every one of those issues, you got to think before you start screening and particularly accepting students, how do they fit into our protocols? How do they fit into our curriculum? And what demands are we going to make on that student? And there may be none. We've had programs where you're training flaggers to guide trucks that contain hazardous materials, and they may not need any of those physical attributes or academic attributes. They may have some minimum standards, basic GED, maybe not even that. Most employers, and we'll talk about that in a second, will require that. So what the point I'm getting across, and we'll talk about that in the notes, is all of these things will go into how you're going to screen, what you're going to require of your students. And screening is basically a funnel. You're basically getting a lot of people, and out of that, you're getting the cream of the crop. And I want to say this. This is a program to help the disadvantaged, the underserved, unemployed, underemployed populations. We want to do good, and we want to help people that are most deserving. But the next thing I'm going to say, and of course, everyone has the right to apply, but you've got 20 seats, 22 seats, maybe 25 seats, and some of those people may drop out. You're rationing seats. And depending on your community, if you don't have a large people that want to enter this program, that's one thing. But if you've got 100 people that want to do this, you're rationing. And for every person you let in who is not employable or is going along for the ride or not fully capable or can't do the work or figures they don't have the motivation, you're cheating someone and you're taking away their seat. So the way you have to look at this is, do we call it the cream of the crop? I would say the most capable of doing the work, getting a job, and has the desire to run the program, to go through the program. And that's what we're looking for. And it's hard-nosed. I mean, it's whether it's like picking a baseball team or being on The Voice, whatever, it's tough because you're going to have to, when you have a lot of candidates, you're going to have a lot of capable candidates. And it's tough to turn someone down. But we're going to talk about that, too, in a second. So when we break this down, we look into the easy ones are the subjective screens. And these are skill and knowledge assessments. The basic one, of course, is a GED or a high school diploma. And that's fine for some people. If you have a GED, high school diploma, your curriculum may say, we can work with these people. Your instructors may say, we can work with these people. Your employers may say, the people we're going to be looking for employment, that's fine. GED is good for you. That's all you need. As your program becomes more sophisticated, and I'm not saying one's better or worse than the other. It's just where you're at and what kind of program you're going to establish, what your target group is, and what your employers require. As we get more sophisticated, we start doing these evaluation tools. The most common, probably the TABE, the TAB tests, Adult Basic Education. It's recognized by TANF and Department of Labor, Department of Transportation. In fact, it's recognized by the military for advancement, welfare to work, DOT, truck drivers have to qualify for this TAB test. And it's basically reading and math skills, language. It's an easy test to administer. Now, these tests are often administered by the WIB, which we've talked about in the past and will in the future, your job corps center, the WIB, the job center. They've got lots of different names, but they'll administer the test and they'll do some screening for you. And the screening they provide is good screening, but it's not everything. And we'll talk about that in a second. But they can administer the TAB test. And of course, once you take it, well, what level? And some go 6-8, and many go 8-10, 7-8, 9-10. In urban populations, we've got many candidates. They may require 7-10 on the TAB test. Areas where there might not be as many applicants or your curriculum is fairly basic and the jobs you'll be applying for are fairly basic, 6-8. May be fine. So that's going to be incorporated in your protocol and as your applications start coming in. And again, It's not first in line. Get your application started early. Do a lot of awareness, lots of orientation nights to get interest and buzz going on getting as many people in as possible. The next level up is the CASAS, CASAS, Comprehensive Adult Student Assessment Systems. Many of our grantees use that. It's math, reading, writing, listening, speaking. The nice thing about that is they have a workforce skills certificate, and many employers, it's just another plus in getting a job at the end of the pike. If you have a workforce skills certificate, you can say, all of these people have taken this test. The results are available. They have a certificate developed with the Department of Ed, Department of Labor. It's probably the step up from the TAB test. The other one that's often used by some are work keys. Not as many use work keys, but it's a National Career Readiness NRC certificate. That's a little more sophisticated, yet math, reading, and interpretation, reading for information. And it's got four levels, a platinum, a gold, a silver, and a bronze. And the higher you score, similar to the TAB test, the higher level. For our grantees, usually the silver level is what's commonly used. So it's about bronze is the lowest, silver is the next up, and then gold and platinum. So that's a objective placement tool that could be used. And you could use all or none of these, as I said before. One caution that almost every grantee will say is don't rely solely on these objective tests, because they'll give you a good idea of the capability of someone, but the most important is not that. The most important is what we talked about, and will that desire and ability to be employed. So given the quantitative tests, another screening test that some use and some don't, the drug tests. Yes, no, maybe, pre-screen. Everyone does a pre-screen before they can get in the program. Some do a random screen while they're in the program. Some do a drug test before they can graduate. Some won't graduate unless they pass a drug test. Some don't require a drug test. Through the entire application process and through the entire training program, they say that our employers are likely to screen. And if you're out there, you're on your own. And it's up to you what kind of reputation you're going to give the program and give yourself. So you're on your own. Now, whether you give a drug test will depend a lot on two things. One, the availability. Usually HHS will, your Health and Human Services, it's a good leveraging opportunity. Someone will do those tests for you. Another question is how available they are, and how extensive do you want to get into the drug test. They have five panel tests. These are tests that are mandatory by the Department of Transportation. They do workplace drug testing, and they do them once a year, and then plus for random testing. The five panel tests for everything you would expect, amphetamines, methamphetamines, cocaine, marijuana, PCP, and opioids, and those are the drug tests on the five panel. There's also a 10-panel test, and that adds another five drugs to it. One of our grantees said they actually even have a 17-panel test. I'm not familiar with that. Anyone out there that does drug testing, and what type of testing they do? Hello? Can any of you hear me? Okay.
Yes, I can hear you.
David, your grandma hears you.
Okay. Have I been interrupted lately, or everyone's just on quiet mode? Can you
unmute mode?
We're muted.
You're unmuted. Okay, we're good. You know, I'm. Have you been able to hear me in the last?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that's good because you know we've had sessions where I've talked to myself for 15 minutes. So until someone finally called me, so I'm glad to hear that someone's listening. Okay. Well, you can do 5-panel or 10-panel. A lot will be depend on your employers, but more so on what you can get out of your leverage partners. It's becoming easier and easier. But if you can get the health service to do these for you, it's free as a leverage partner. Do you have to do it? Again, that's optional. We've got excellent grantees who don't do testing. We've got excellent grantees who actually do rehabilitation in their program. And they make sure that everyone who goes out the door is drug-free. Now, some of these chemicals don't stay in your system. Some stay in your system for quite a while, so it's something to consider. So the drug test. So we've talked about an academic type test. We've talked about the drug test. There's also physical tests. These are all screening methods. And I mentioned that if you're going to be having a curriculum where you have to lift and then lift 30 pounds, lift 50 pounds, that's definitely a screen and a protocol. If you're going to be in confined space, you obviously can't be afraid of confined space. If you're going to be doing asbestos removal with your hands above your head for long extended periods of time, you have to be doing that. Certainly, if you're doing fit tests and you'll be using respirators, you're going to need physicals. We've actually had people in programs who have had heart attacks and with SCBA gear, and that's something that's mandatory. So it all goes back to what your curriculum looks like, whether or not you're going to have to get a physical or ask people if they can perform these particular duties. It's just something you have to do. Now, from a legal point of view, you know, you have to accept all applications. Everyone who wants to join should be able to send in an application. Depending, and this is another reason to have a definite protocol established and written protocol, what you're going to be doing. Those who get into the program and those who apply, of course, we've seen it, what happens at universities. Well, this isn't exactly that. But when you start talking about subjective tests or objective tests, you've got to have this issue of why wasn't I accepted into this program? It's a free program. I have the right. It's a federal program. It's a free program. I have the right to apply. Yes, you do. But if you can't be employed, if you can't handle the academic rigor, if you can't handle the physical rigor, you're going to end up dropping out, and you're going to be taking a seat away from someone else. So, again, that's where you have to get hard-nosed. So we've covered all of the subjective, the objective tests, which are easier. Now we get down to subjective screening. And having talked all this time about the objective testing, the screens that you can do and should do, now we get to the hard part. You've got 50 people who've passed all those screens, and you got to get down to 25 or 20. Now what do you do? Now we go to the subjective. And what is the subjective testing? Are you going to stick with the program? Are you going to complete the 6 weeks? Are you going to attend every session? Never be tardy. Are you determined to start a new career? Are you going to stick this thing out? When things get tough, are you just going to quit and say, this is just too hard? Do you work well in groups? Environmental remediation is a team sport. Everyone has to work together. The guy behind you is going to be saving you if you get into trouble. So it's no different than the military. You've got to work well and work in groups. Do you take these challenges? Do you accept them and look forward? Do you have a real passion for a new career? Or are you just going to this class just because you're unemployed or you got nothing else to do or it's free? Are you really determined to start fresh? And of course, last, will potential employers hire you? That's a tough one. But it gets back to what we said very early in the session. When you talk to employers, they're going to tell you, this is who we were looking for. This is who we're hiring for entry positions. This is who we won't hire. And we're flipping all the way back to when they graduate. Are they employable? So how do we get to these subjective screening and assessment protocols that I'm just talking about? Well, as several grantees have told me, make it as hard as possible to get into your program. Now, again, we're talking with, we're trying to screen 100 down to 25. Have multiple orientations. You come to the first one, you've got 600 people. Come to the second one, you have 300 people. Now you have to fill out an application. Now you've got 100 people. So we're doing a screening, and this screening is, what kind of desire do you have? Are you really interested in this program? Are you interested enough to go to two orientations or travel across town or go to a class? Are you interested in that? Are you interested in doing personal interviews? Will you allow us to sit down with your family and you together to talk about this? These are levels of screen that grantees have used extremely successful. And by the way, they seem to have the highest retention rates and the highest employment rates of the grantees. You want to talk to them about their desires, and almost everyone will tell you, and the people doing these interviews are the trainers and the staff, and you might even have a student in there talking to someone about the program. But we just got put on hold. Okay, repeat. Please don't put us on hold. Thank you for taking us off. The other approach, and these are all used in tandem together or sometimes individually. The other one is pre-training. And what we're doing in pre-training is we're taking the 100 people, by this time might be down to 75 or maybe less, and we're going to put them into a class. We're going to offer them a life skills course or a use of tools or health and safety. We might do team building exercises. And we're going to put them in a pre-training class that might be a couple of weeks, maybe a week or two. And we're going to watch them perform. This is overlapping with the next one I'm going to talk about. But we're going to give them some basic training that they would need anyway for the program. Very similar to that is the tryouts that many of you who are existing grantees are, we've talked about a lot. OAI has done tremendous things with tryouts, as well as Cypress Mandela. And basically in tryouts, you're actually putting them through almost like a basic training. And you're trying some team building exercises. You're combining with some classes, and you're observing them all the way. And it's almost like, watch them perform, watch how they act, put them in a stressful situation, see if they get angry, make it not easy. And all the time your instructors, your staff are looking at these people and say, I think this guy's a natural fit. I think he can do the job. And it's easy to find, to detect those people. The people who have the most fortunate screening methods are people like Cypress, who actually have a construction program. And they're able to look at them over 6 or 8 weeks or some sort of a Jobs for Youth program where they're enrolled in a different program on, say, usually the construction trades. And they're able to watch the students perform and work with them and instruct them. And then as the end approaches, they might go to the few that they feel would be really good in this as environmental remediation technicians, and they may approach them and say, you know, you've gone through 6 weeks, but here's an opportunity to become even more valuable to employers, and that would be to come into the 6-week environmental workforce development program. And this is what we're going to teach you. And if you're interested in that, you'll not only have the construction trades, but you'll have the environmental remediation trades, health and safety, and you'll be a very valuable employer when you get out. So these are what we call the tryouts. And whether you use and you may use all three of them. If you use the difficult to get into program approach, personal interviews are really important. Family interviews, combine that perhaps with a pre-training. You might be doing use of tools, a life skills, which is free, a safety and health program. You can actually do some of your life skills training, which EPA doesn't support, but your leverage partners will. Do your life skills first. And then knowing that that doesn't mean you're going to be in the program, but it's something, it's a free training that you're offering everyone. And, of course, this might go in combination with your objective assessment tools. But then you're going to be able to bring your class down to 25 or so to 20 and select the best people who are the best suited for the jobs that you're looking for, that your employers are looking for. So it's this combination of making awareness, recruiting as many people as you can to apply, going through your objective tests if you need to, going into your subjective tests, and then finally coming up with the best team that you could possibly come up with in your cohort. And of course, as a final note, many people have student contracts, which is just, it's a non-binding contract, can't really be enforced, but it's a contract that you make them aware of that at the end of this, it's not enforceable, but they're going to give you a promissory agreement that they will attend all the classes. They perhaps will subject to drug tests. When they graduate, they have a responsibility to come back and work with the program, help your new participants, and also give the ability to track and contact the employer. And that is a contract they sign and gives them a commitment to understand what you're going to give them, what they could expect from you, and what you can expect from them. And just a final word, those who don't make it, we have to consider what responsibility do we have.
Hello?
Yes. Hello? Someone there? Okay. What responsibility do we have for people who are capable but do not make the final cut? And the answer to that is, if you can, become aware of other training programs. To sit down, and you have two choices. You may not be perfectly fit for this program, but we have another program I think you would do well in. That is one approach, and you need to be a little aware of that. And you want to leave those people who don't make particularly the end cuts with an opportunity that this was not a total waste of time for them. Another possibility is to suggest that they enroll in the next cohort. These would be students who you've got really capable people, but here is someone who you know could probably make it, but you just don't have a seat for them. Encourage them to hang on there for the next cohort, which might be 6 months away, and say, we're filled here, but I want to put you in line for this next one. And these would be for these very special students. So essentially what we did today is to talk about how to whittle your class down, how to pick the best students. And it's probably one of the most difficult jobs in the whole program, aside from placing them when they graduate. But if you've got really good students coming in, the chances of your graduates finding jobs, or you finding jobs for them, is excellent. It really is. Does anyone have any questions or observations or things that they ran across during their years and working with this? Any ideas or suggestions? Okay. Well, by the time you get these notes, the RFP may be out, and we'll be talking from now on about responding to that RFP and the evaluation criteria. So with that, I kept you a little over, but you all have a good week and look out for the announcement and the RFP, which will be on the listserv. So everyone have a good week and good luck when you get this, and don't panic when you get it. Just start plotting it out, and we'll be with you on a good approach to writing this grant. You're going to have 2 months, so take your time. Talk to you all soon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.